You know, I had a chance to obviously hear from Jacob and also some from Randy, and I tell you what, there's some heavy things that's happening in the life of our school, isn't there? So I'm still very much learning. I'm learning about the Canadian context. I'm still learning about life and education here. I come from a very conservative area in Texas, and but one of the things that when I speak to educators in the States, it's that take notes of what's happening in Canada because it's coming down very quickly. So I am very concerned and very interested in what's happening in the life of our school and in the life of this school system. And so I do try to keep in touch, but some of the things that Randy pointed out were quite startling, as I'm sure they were startling for you. How many of you, I'm just very curious, have heard or have seen some of what Randy has described? I mean, the throwing of the desk, you have seen these things, the yelling at the teachers, it is surprising. For me, at least. Maybe not for you, because this has almost become the norm. And one of the things that Randy pointed out that I'm just now just really curious about, it sounds like there is more discipline given for a student speaking out against what is promoted as far as the social liberal agenda than by throwing a desk across the room. So that's startling when an idea is harshly punished and disciplined than actual physical violence. So, but let's move on to some happier things, shall we? I wanted to start off with, in a classical education, you have to have Bill Watterson. So this is one of my favorites, Calvin and Hobbes. Now, this is the title, you know, students today, they're caught in an identity crisis. And I think this is most poignant when it comes to Christians trying to navigate faithfully the educational landscape. And so there's Calvin and his transmogrifer, and he becomes a little small Hobbes. It's pretty cute. So we'll start with that. But now let's move on. But I do want to say that students today that were caught in an identity crisis. Children, and I think that we can look at children, and I think we can look at the biblical accounts about how the Bible describes children, and if you have children of your own, then you know this is probably very true, that children are very natural born learners. They love to learn. It's very easy for them. It's very natural for them. And this is evidenced by delight, wonder, curiosity, interest, discovery, questions, memorizations, and so much more. One of my favorite conversations to have with parents is when a child is entering junior kindergarten or senior kindergarten, and they tell me about how bright their child is because they can memorize 30 to 60 catechisms. They've memorized scripture. They know their ABCs. And I get to tell them, your child's not bright. That's normal. And that's exciting because it's all just so wonderful and interesting to them that it just becomes very natural and easy for them to memorize those things and to learn. It's harder for us. How many of you are on a Bible memorization plan and you just have been memorizing the same thing over and over again, and the child then turns it into a quick little song and then they have it? So it's very natural for children. But The crisis becomes in that schools, the public education system, even some Christian education, and classical schools are not immune from this either, that we tend to stifle that curiosity, that wonder, that delight, because we have certain outcomes that we have to achieve. We'll talk about that in a minute. But one book that I do want to commend to you is, let's see here, if I can move this on. Oh, man. Is it on back there, Randy? Sorry, it's frozen on mine. I'll tell you the name of the book. It's by Susan Schaefer-Macaulay, and it's called For the Children's Sake. for the children's sake. And this is a book that when I first came across it, I came across it in a, oh, you're going to move them along for me? Okay, thank you. Great. And when I first came across the book, we had received as our school 5 years ago is when we first started, a big book collection that we were sorting through. And there was a group of books that I was told, sort through these. We haven't heard these titles and these authors, so if you would look through them. So I picked up this book, and I saw the cover, and I thought, I'm not interested in that. But then I saw the name, Susan Schaefer Macaulay, and I thought, Schaefer, I wonder if there's a connection to Francis Schaefer. And sure enough, this is his daughter who wrote this book. I became interested, I picked it up, and out of all of my educational background, this is probably the most forming in as far as what I believe now in education. So this is a must read. You'll be inspired by it. It's very, very good. But one of the things that she promotes is the idea that children love to learn. They're natural at it. And then there's something about the school system and the way that we do it that begins to remove those things from the child. Or, as we like to say, we like to mature the child. Well, when you mature a child, it doesn't mean that you would take these things away from them, but we want to enhance it and direct it, form it. So keep that book in mind. So the crisis, this identity crisis that we have, is what our modern education has become. For the past 150 years, starting with Horace Mann and John Dewey, secular education has removed inquiry, delight, wonder, what we like to call the poetic knowledge, to the learning of facts and skills that are relevant for the workforce. It's a post-industrial revolution where the classroom moves children through information and skills designed for vocations. In the early 2000s and late 1990s, when George Bush, we had the No Child Left Behind. And the emphasis there is not on necessarily knowledge, but it is knowledge, but it's knowledge that leads to skills. It's very much a focus on skills base for the workforce. And we want to switch that and say that if you focus on a humanities approach, if we work on developing the humanity of a child, then the skills will come. Tech companies are discovering this little gem. They're actually hiring more and more graduates that have a philosophy or a humanities degree than those who have an actual specific skill in coding or in engineering and such. Because what they're finding out is that people who have a humanities background are more empathetic. They lead better meetings, more efficient with time, and they can take ideas, logically work those things out, and come up with a better solution. So it's interesting that there is kind of a resurgence just to the idea of a humanities approach. So I have a video, and this is the next slide here, Randy. We'll play this real fast, and then we'll talk about it. So what I want to propose and what Randy has encouraged us to talk about and to think deeply about is a better alternative. And that's where we come in with the idea of what is classical education. I'm actually going to try to use that term classical very limited because sometimes we can get lost in the jargon of classical education. So we're going to try to work through some of those things. Now, what I'm going to propose to you is a Christian education leading a child to wisdom, virtue, and Christian maturity. Now, those are important terms. Wisdom, virtue, and in our setting, in thinking about Christianity and Christian education and forming a child and forming the soul, we're going to say Christian maturity, godliness. And I want to say that it's best manifested in a robust liberal arts or, in this day, classical education. In 1936, Harvard College was established as a school for ministry, preparation. And it followed a very classical approach. Now, they would not say that they were necessarily classical because that was just the norm. The way that they learned, the way that they studied, the way that they looked at life was just very much in a classical way. And we'll look at this next slide because one of the classical ways that they did it was they had original rules. And this is one of the original rules for its students. It says, "Let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies." And what is that? That is to know God and Jesus Christ, and then therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. What a great place to start. Before you start education, before you send your child to JK, or before you enroll them into a school, look at what is the goal? It's the foundation of looking at Christ in all aspects, in all fields, in all subjects. So, the sentiment here is the crux of a classical Christian education. Christ is the foundation and the end. All learning, all knowledge, all pursuits is towards a maturity and growth in Christ. That's our starting point. Now, a more faithful form of education is one where every subject, discipline, arts, and when I talk about arts, I'm saying something like the language and the mathematical arts, point your child to the characteristics and attributes of God. Nothing is lost, and everything, Christian maturity, wisdom, godly virtue, as mentioned before, is gained. So Martin Luther was also onto something whenever he said this. If we can switch the slide, it says, this is a letter that he wrote to the councilmen of all the cities in Germany that they established and maintained Christian schools. What a title. It says, "If I had children and could manage it, I would have them study not only languages and history, but also singing and music together with the whole of mathematics." The ancient Greeks trained their children in these disciplines. They grew up to be people of wondrous ability, subsequently fit for everything. Now that very ending, subsequently fit for everything, is what we want to focus on. Because when you think of a robust liberal arts education, or if you think of what is classical, you think of something that's very limited. When what we want to say is it's actually very broadening. It actually opens up more opportunities for your child. Opens up opportunities for them to be of an influence in the world around them. Not just in the area of sharing and evangelizing, this taking dominion, which I love, this idea of taking dominion. And I do think that if we do classical education right, then we can take dominion of a lot of all areas of life. And later on, I'll also tell you that one of the most easiest and basic ways of taking dominion and of instilling in your children godly wisdom and virtue is what's called through the moral imagination. It's through good stories. I think that if we focus on just putting in front of our kids good stories that have sound morals and even can provide a contrast. So, for example, what makes in the story of someone like Beauty and the Beast, what makes beauty so beautiful? Well, it's in contrast to the ugliness of the beast. And those are stories that are good and powerful. Sometimes whenever I have discipline issues with the student and the teacher says, "Well, what should I do?" I tell them, "Well, in your read aloud time, let's be intentional in the stories that we read to them." And one of those is the Chronicles of Narnia. And I think that we had one particular boy who struggled with behavior. So Westminster and Christian schools are not immune to the kids pushing the boundaries. But in this situation, we didn't know what to do necessarily. We had worked with the parents on this, and we were kind of at a loss of what to do because the child was really dominating and affecting the learning environment. We couldn't have that. So we just began to read good stories to him because he had a really vivid imagination, and that was the idea. And in that, he began, and this was a point, because he saw the contrast between Eustace, if you remember the stories, I think it was... Whenever Eustace becomes a dragon, Voyage of Don Treader, he becomes a dragon, and so he saw himself as someone who was like Eustace and not like the Pevensey kids. And that was a powerful moment for him when he realized maybe kids don't like me or I'm rubbing them wrong because of my behavior. Power of stories. So I think that a lot can gain, especially when you look at what schools are being, what children are being fed in their schools. Go to your public library. Go to your if you do attend a public school, then go to your child's school library and look at the book of the month. Just compare it and see what they put out there. And so, there's a quote from Martin Luther. For general Christian education, I think that we've been going about it all wrong. What is needed is not just a collection of kids and families under a commonality of a general statement of faith, or the inclusion of just a Bible class or a chapel service, or even Christian teachers. I think there needs to be a little bit more than just those things, those elements that make it a Christian school. Deuteronomy teaches a rhythm of life where Christ is all and in all, taking every moment to teach the attributes of God. And when we apply the same rhythm to education, we get a different, and I believe a more faithful and robust form of education, where every language arts and every mathematical arts point you to the character and attribute of God. Now, I do have to qualify that, because not every lesson that we give is going to be a, kids, here's how you see Jesus in this addition problem. But it's an overarching theme that everything we do is going to point to it. So, for example, when we teach math, we're going to say that God loves numbers. And he loves numbers so much that he has perfectly proportioned the earth away from the sun. So if we were any bit closer, we would burn up. Any bit further, we would be very, very cold. But instead, through numbers, through mathematics, God has perfectly proportioned us so that we can take dominion, so that we can be the image bearers. Isn't it interesting that God uses numbers? So hopefully our kids are hearing those messages and recognizing that even though I'm not mathematically bent, for example, and it's more than just appreciating it, but it is loving it because God loves it. And when all the subjects and disciplines that we teach come from that standpoint, then that builds into the child that there's more at stake. There's more involved than just a Bible class or just a chapel service or just that my teacher is Christian. So everything that we do is declared back to God. So we want to find out the attributes and characteristics of God. Christian classical education, here's an idea that we want to incline our hearts to God. So the first area we as Christians must care for is our own personal piety. Our own personal piety. You as the parent, that's what I'm talking about. We'll talk about the kids in a minute, but let's start with you as the parent. Your own personal piety. And in your own personal piety, the Bible and the Lord ask you to weigh yourself against Scripture. All aspects of life and whether they are a benefit to your Christian walk or not. So it could be, how much time do you spend binging on Netflix or playing video games? Or even how you spend your money, how you spend your vacations, how you spend your time with others. The Bible has something to say about all those things. And it becomes a Philippians 4:8 question about your own personal piety. And there it is. So you want to focus on whatever is good, true, noble, right, pure, excellent, worthy of praise. And as an adult, you are responsible to order your life around these principles, around these ideas. And so that is your own personal piety. Do you want the same for your children? As a Christian, you undoubtedly would say, absolutely. And so you put before your kids. My daughter is, she's funny right now. My daughter is six. She just turned six. She's in grade one at our school. When you talk about discipline, we don't have chairs being thrown, but I do remember my daughter biting another child. So we have to deal with that kind of stuff too. Again, we're not immune from those things. But she is having, right now, she will be in a conversation. All of a sudden, she'll stop and she said, I just had a bad thought. I was like, what's that? What a bad thought is that? And she says, well, I just thought that it could be anything, that I wish that my friend had fallen down and hurt themselves. And it's like, well, that's a terrible thought. And so then what will we do? We'll point her back to Philippians 4:8. We did this, in fact, last night, where we said, let's talk about what you're thinking. Not everything has to come out of your mouth, but let's do change your thought process away from what is bad. And it's, so it's the putting off and the putting on. If we do that, and we want our children to do that, don't we also want a school that is going to seek and pursue and embody the same things? So it becomes a big Philippians 4:8 question. So then as parents, if this is a big concern for you, your own personal piety, it's a big concern for your pastor, and it's a big concern for maybe even your family. Well, we have a command in Proverbs 11:1 that says this, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord. That's a strong word, abomination. But if this is what we believe as Christian parents and personal piety, and we want our children to do the same, but yet we're sending them to a school that we know is antithetical to our Christian beliefs, that is something that is of concern. It becomes a false balance. Now, that's the first area. The second area, then, is your home. So to emphasize this point, I'm going to quote from Jason, boy, tough name, Halopoulos, I think that's right, Halopoulos, from his book, A Neglected Grace. It's a small one. It's a good one. I'd encourage you to check it out, about family worship specifically. But this is what he says. It is easy to settle into the mindset that the goal in raising children is to prepare them to be mature individuals who, when they leave to go out into the world, they're competent, they're ready for the world. If you look at any Christian school and you look at their vision and mission statement, it's going to be that. They're going to be leaders in this world. Well, I got to tell you, not every child is going to be a leader. But we can be a positive influence in our sphere of life. So let's continue on. And it's actually a bigger picture than just being an influence in this world. That's what he says. Nope, sorry, go back. But that isn't enough. You and I, as Christian parents, can't be content with something so limited and small. Wow. As Christian parents, our goal in raising our children is not to prepare them for going out into the world as fully functioning adults. Our goal as Christian parents is to prepare our children for eternity. And this is where wisdom, because where was wisdom? And this is, I love, I think it's Psalm 8, I believe. Maybe it's Proverbs 8, I can't remember. But when it talks about how wisdom was before the foundation of the world, wisdom was before the foundation of the world. Wisdom will extend after the world is gone. And aren't those things that we want for our children? Wisdom and virtue? So in order to do this, though, what's needed is not just a breadth of knowledge, but an equally rich depth of knowledge that pursues wisdom and virtue for your child. Randy mentioned that about there's so many subjects to cover in a day, and that you're just touching on just topics of it. So, for example, grade 9. Anybody have high school students? Okay, a few. Well, in high school, if you were to go, and I'm just going to speak about the Toronto District School Board, in the TDSB, when you're in grade 9 and also in grade 10, you take a science class in order to receive credits for the OSSD. You're taking grade 9 science, you're taking physics, chemistry, biology, and astronomy. Four huge disciplines within 1 year. That's an omnibus style. Now, you'll go a little bit deeper in year two when you're in grade 10, but that's a lot to cover. That's a lot to explore. But why do they do that? They do that, so they can get those things out of the way so that in grade 11 and 12, you have a university that you want to get to, and so your classes are tailored to get to that university. So education, success then becomes that university, if I can just get there. So then you're really limiting these subjects. What God has created as wonderful and beautiful, good and true, it's boiled down to, let's get through these quickly so that we can move on to more important things applicable to you and what you want to get in life. So we have a grade 11 student in our school. We're doing high school a little bit differently. We're kind of taking a risk, but I'm excited about that. And I have some parents that I've convinced to go along with me. So if you speak with passion enough, then parents will jump on board without really knowing what you're talking about. But we have a girl in grade 11 that she was with us for three years in grades 6, 7, and 8. Then in grade 9, she went to a Christian school just north of the city. And then in the summer, or at the end of that year of grade 9, she came back to me, and on her initiative, which is just a principal's privilege, wow, this is really honoring, she said that she's not enjoying the classes because she sees that even in a Christian school setting, geography is pushed to a certain social agenda. It's dealing more with environmental concerns than actually like geography. And so she said this to me. She said, whatever you put together is better than what I was receiving over there. And now, we had been preparing for a high school anyway, so I said, well, you understand that you're going to be the only student in this, you know, high school. We're still working out the kinks, and so are you willing to be truly the guinea pig for the high school students coming after you? And she said, whatever you put together is better. Well, that's really honoring. And so, unfortunately for her, though, she's very, she loves the arts, she loves theater and such, but I'm requiring her to not do the omnibus style of high school, so physics, astronomy, chemistry, and biology. I'm asking her to take a full year of just of those things. Now, she was really nervous about that, but we stay in a lot of touch together just to make sure that what we're doing is right. We're not pushing too hard, and we're not going too slow. It's at a good pace for her. She has a good touch on those things too. And she is, when she never thought she would enjoy physics or biology, she is loving it because it's done in the lens of understanding who God is more and more. So I think that there is something that honors the mind and it glorifies God in that. This idea of taking knowledge, not just spreading ourselves too thin, but focusing on a few, but mining the depths of them. The next slide kind of describes this again. This is from John Ruskin. It says, the entire object of true education is to make people not merely do the right things, but to enjoy the right things. In Christian schools, one of my biggest concerns at a Christian school is that we have children that just do the right things but not love it. Because then you just have a bunch of pretentious kids, and I don't want that. Prideful kids. The Lord goes against the pride, but he gives grace to the humble. So I want the students to love to do the right thing because it glorifies God and honors the Lord. Not merely industrious, but to love industry. Not merely learned, but to love knowledge. Not merely pure, but to love purity. Not merely just, but to hunger and thirst after justice. I think a lot of truth in that. It's helpful for us. We also know that King Solomon, the preacher in Ecclesiastes, he felt the same way. And I think that Solomon was very much classically educated. So let's look at what King Solomon says. This is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 9 and on. It says this, not only was the teacher wise, if you switch slides there, Randy, but he also imparted knowledge. Ooh, it's kind of hard to see, but look at the bolded words. Teacher was wise. He also imparted knowledge. He was a teacher to the people. He pondered, he thought. He thought deeply about these things, and he searched out, and he set in order. Do you see all those words that describes the master teacher? Hopefully, the teacher of your school is putting just as much time and attention to their lesson planning in this way, that they're looking to impart the knowledge to that child, but in order to do that, they themselves have to ponder and search out and set in order in order for them to make sense to the child. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. One problem that we have with classical education is that we put before our students things that are too heavy too early. So, but it looks nice on paper, and that's why we do it. And it's a struggle, something we have to kind of fight against. I mean, we can read Augustine's Confessions in grade 8. We can read it in grade 5. Now, meaning they can read the words, but they won't understand it. And then we can put on paper that, look what our students are doing. They're reading Augustine at grade 5. And so then it becomes really nice and impressive. But do the students understand that? So I think that what Solomon is doing here is he's searching out to find just the right words. He's putting the material that's appropriate to the age level before the students. Now, I will say this, that a student who has a liberal arts education or a classical education will desire more than what is typically put in front of them in a public school. I don't think we give our kids enough credit to what they can actually do. And that's even with special education also. So, let's try that. Let's find just the right words. And then he wrote what was upright and true. And then going back to that real fast, the words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. But he says this, be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. So that's an interesting word about scripture. Don't add anything to them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. So that's an important reminder for teachers also to maybe keep the lesson short. Go outside for a little bit. Renew yourself through the sun. I mean, don't you as adults need a little breaks in the day? Yeah, so do students. Then he says in verse 13 and 14, now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. This is the conclusion of education. Fear God. That's it. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. The work of a classical education upon a person is the rightly ordered affections, as we called earlier about that John Ruskin wrote about. And what we do as classical educators, our goal is to lead our students not just doing the right things, but to love doing what is right. Now, let's get a little more specific into the goals of Christian classical education. What are the goals? Here are some of the goals. They are trained by the task ahead of them. Trained by the task ahead of them. They are relational. Students ought to be relational. I'm going to come back to a few of these and flesh it out a little bit more. They're marked by well-ordered habits. They have a cultivated moral imagination. It's mastery-based. Randy touched on that. It's not child-centered. Now, a little caveat there. We are in the business of children, right? So it is centered on a child, but it's not dictated by the child, which a lot of schools are now really promoting. And I will say, for example, anyone familiar with Montessori education? Okay. Within Montessori education, if you really trace it back to its origins, it's very similar to classical education. But then as it grows and expands and it goes out into different regions, it changes slightly. So there is a branch of Montessori called Montessori Casa. And in Montessori Casa, as in many schools now, it's very much a child-centered approach to education. Now, what does that mean? A child-centered approach to education means that the child is in charge. Now, I'm speaking very directly on this. But children have their own proclivities. They have the things that they want to do. And what's nice about it is that a parent thinks, oh, my child's going to become an artist. And so when they go into the classroom, they go to the art center, and they just begin to throw paint against the canvas there, and they begin to paint and have fun. And in a child-centered education, it's thought that let's explore that, let's grow that, let's cultivate that. But at some point, the teacher needs to come alongside and say, you know what, let's move on to something new. Let's move on to something else. In a child-centered education, the child can say no. And the teacher says, okay, we'll continue on. Because that's what the child wants to do. That's what they're cultivating. But what's also interesting in that, and Randy touched on this as well, is a teacher can't say you're doing that wrong. If a child begins to draw an elephant, but it looks like an airplane, the teacher can't say that's a really nice airplane. The child says, no, that's an elephant. The teacher can't say, no, that's not an elephant. That's an airplane. Because to the child, that's what it is. You don't want to squash a child's feelings and tell them that their work is not beautiful. So that's child-centered education. It's child-directed. And we don't want to go there. Because I believe that as adults, we have the child's best interests in mind. We know the information we want them to have, especially if it's in a Christian school towards godliness and towards virtues and character. So we want to direct that. And I also think that the teachers we put in front of our students are master teachers. And those are the people that we want our students to emulate. So it all connects that way. And so it's not child-centered. And then we also, a student is cognizant that ideas have consequences. And they are also steeped in great historical thought and invention. Now, there's a person named Winston Churchill. And in the 1950s, Winston Churchill basically was given a college, Churchill College at Cambridge. And so, in this, Churchill was a master. If you're familiar with Winston Churchill, Churchill was a master at language. He was brilliant with history and geography. And he was even a prophet in foreseeing the consequences of ideas. So when he developed the scope for the college was naturally for him an emphasis on science and technology. Isn't that interesting? A man so equipped and well-versed in the humanities and in language and geography and brilliant in understanding logic and having the strong rhetoric, he wanted to focus on science and technology. Well, why is that? Because students who were enrolled in this college of science and technology, here's what they would receive. They would receive philosophy, politics, economics, Greek, Latin, and that's an ancient history, and that's all the core subjects. Every student had to have that. Then it went on to modern languages, chemistry, biology, mathematics, physics, and other subjects that relate then to science and technology. Because he is coming out of, he had just witnessed the immoral and devastating influence of modern science and technology put into the hands of wicked men with evil intentions, and that was in Nazi Germany. He felt that the continuation of these pursuits without wisdom potentially leads to ill intentions. So then, our young men and women need to recognize their minds have great potential for good and evil, and they will be marked by how they use this in the task of life ahead of them. Hopefully, Lord willing, it's only by the Lord's grace that this can happen, is that we hope our students would have great wisdom through these subjects. We're not just teaching subjects. That's not the goal. The goal is wisdom. We want them to understand these things so that they can be wise and influential. So that whenever society gets a little out of whack, we can have this approach and say, hey, we've seen this in history before. It's not going to go well. Hey, but here's what's happening in our public education today, across the board, especially in the States, in fact, is they're not teaching history at all. They're removing it. It's a waste of time. It's not relevant to us anymore. Science and technology, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, that's what we should be teaching our kids nowadays. So history, not at all. It's fascinating. It's concerning. The other thing that they are is that they are relational. And they're relational on two levels. They're relational with ideas to people and places. And these ideas are what drive society. And because of their understanding and sense of history, they're able to determine whether these ideas are worth pursuing. And so they ask the question. Here's the big question. Not what can you do, because you can do a lot of things. You can do those things. But what ought you to do? You see the difference in that question? That's a better question to ask. Try that. When you're talking with your child about a book in literature, so you read a story, it could be Eustace or it could be the Narnia series, and you say, what ought Susan have done in that situation? Not what can they do. Try that on your own child whenever a discipline issue comes up. And you say, in this situation, this is in with families, you're fully aware of this, but you know your children pretty well. So you know when you put them into a situation, you kind of foresee how it's going to happen. So you have to kind of coach them through, okay, this child is going to do this. How are you going to respond? So again, the question is not what can you do, but the question is what ought you to do when the situation comes up? You see the difference. So, and then also, classical education. Oh, the second way that they are relational is they look and find ways to help their fellow man, help fellow humans. They're not learning and receiving knowledge just to be used in a vacuum, just for their own good pleasure. But instead, it is to love God further and then care for their neighbor. The first great command and the second that's like it. That's the goal. And then finally, the classical educated student is marked by well-ordered habits. Now, the problem is that you don't see some of this whenever they're in school. It happens whenever they're in a life, and they have this moment when they're faced with adversity, and then you hope that they remember. You hope they remember what they have learned in school. And so it's mentioned that education is actually just a process of instilling these things so that you remember them later on in those moments of difficulty. So they're marked by well-ordered habits, and unfortunately you don't always see that in those moments. Now with classical education, if those are the goals, there are some convictions that we have in classical education. Here are some of those convictions. And this is the, there it is. One conviction is that children are persons. Schools typically don't treat kids as though they're persons. They have a humanity. They have a personhood. And so that's why it's important that when a teacher, your teacher, comes to the classroom, they present information and they present knowledge and they present a plan, a day's worth of work that builds into their humanity, that builds into their persons. Instead, it's being stripped today. And when you hear about the learning environment that schools are in now, well, the level of discipline doesn't treat kids as though they're persons. The other conviction is that if we believe children to be sacred image bearers, thank you, Jacob, I'm speaking on that one, then our education must honor the mind and respect the soul. Do schools do that now? Well, that's our hope. That's something that we ought to pursue and build upon, that we want to honor the mind. And I tell families that when we have a parent conference or whenever I'm meeting with prospective families, I tell them that I pray that the information I give them honors the mind. I don't want to waste their time. If you're familiar with Charlotte Mason, then one of the things that she says is don't put in front of your kids things that are twaddle. You ever heard of that word twaddle? It's basically pointless, lifeless things. The best example I can give of this is SpongeBob and SquarePants. That is something that is twaddle. And what's telling for us is that we have, our students have a reading log that the students have to fill out every night. You know, parents have to read to them for 15 minutes or whatever. The students, when they're able to read, they have to read books and then they have to log it down. Well, that becomes very helpful to the teacher and to me because then we get to see what the students, the children are filling their minds with at home. And I've been surprised by how much time the students are dealing with comic books or with SpongeBob and SquarePants or things like that. Just twaddle. It's just not, doesn't have any good value to it. It doesn't have any good morals. It's not really even a good story. It's not, sometimes not even good graphics. But why is it on the list? It's on the list because either parents are okay with it or they're not monitoring it themselves. So that's insight for us as educators to then when we do have a parent conference and the child is not growing in reading well or recognizing good stories or character development or plot or things like that, maybe it's because they're feeding their minds on things that just don't have great value. They're not honoring the mind. So our reading list, a classical reading list, is very rich. And sometimes it's also very dense. But all of the stories are very good. Classical, the CCE, I put that of Christian Classical Education, that's what it stands for, has a high emphasis on leading children into wisdom and character. I've spoken on that. Next, CCE nurtures children to a future vision. A future vision. Now, this is fun, and this happened to me this week whenever I have, I love disciplining boys in high school. I like discipline in general. It's a fun thing for me. It probably isn't right to say that, but what it shows is that a child is just acting out on their own will. They're acting out on their own good pleasure, and then Now, the parent has delegated their authority over to me, right? So if you're looking at, in classical education, we also have a high view of authority. So if you look at authority, then you look at God as the ultimate authority. And then I'll just speak about my own personal convictions. The second level then is the father, and then the next level is the mother. But then the Christian school or education, the school in general, is right next to the parents. And their authority, not next to, slightly lower, but next to. That's because the parents are delegating their authority over to the educator. And as a principal of a school, they're handing their child over to me, like Randy said, 5 days a week, 7 hours a day, for me to love on them, to care for them, to nurture them, to cultivate them. And the best way to do that is in discipline. Because that's where the inconsistencies come out. The inconsistencies in academic work or the inconsistencies in character. And I get to speak to it. So it's important that you know your principal, because they could be the disciplinarians in the life of your child, almost maybe sometimes more than you. So whenever this future vision, when I have a high school student that happened this week, we actually have 45-minute blocks for high school, because we have, when they come to class, we got to just get right at it. It's actually to instill a more disciplined environment. Now, we do have a lot of fun. It's, again, we recognize the child's delight and wonder and all those things. We want to cultivate that, but we need to just kind of get right at it. But if a student is late, then they have to come see me. And I have to ask them, why are you late? Well, I was just talking in the hallway. And then for this one student, I said to him, now, this seems to be a habit of showing up late. And then boys, particularly boys, they love to think of their future selves. And for this young man, and he had told me before that he can't wait to be done with school so that he can be a boss and he can do not much work and he can tell other people to do what they want. That's his goal. And so I thought, I'm gonna speak to his future self. And I said, you know, you've been late a lot. If I was your boss, I would fire you. So if you want to be a boss and you had this guy showing up late all the time, and then you had to do his work, because that's what a boss does. If the employees don't show up, then you have to do that work. Work has to get done. I said, so if you start showing up work, I'd fire you. Is that what you want? Is this, because this is becoming a habit. I'm very sympathetic sometimes whenever, you know, you're coming in late or someone else made you late. But if it becomes a habit, then that's concerning. That really spoke to him. He doesn't want to be marked. What young man wants to be marked as a slacker? So we speak to their future vision, to their future selves. Now, let's look to the next slide. What is classical education? We're going to move through this quickly, but let's look at it. You're going to hear terms like the trivium and the quadrivium. If you start doing some reading, and I can give you some literature to read, you're going to come across these terms. What is the trivium? The trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Now, Dorothy Sayers wrote an article, or actually she gave a lecture, it was a summer lecture, but it turned into an essay called The Lost Tools of Learning. And what Dorothy Sayers did is she attributed the grammar, the logic, and the rhetoric into stages of learning. And that's true. That is true. Children go through different stages. So your JK child can memorize the catechisms and they can memorize songs and such like that. It's really cute and you can video it and send it to grandparents. But they do that very easily because that's the grammar stage. That's when you want to pour information into them. And there's not a problem. There is nothing wrong with rote memorization because that is foundational. Because it's in the logic and the rhetoric when you can get to more of the discovery things. So then they move into probably about grade 5 or 6 is when they do the logic stage. They move into a stage of questioning, you know, values and things like that. And the teacher helps them ask those right questions. And then the rhetoric in grade high school, 9 through 12, is when they begin to learn how to speak well and to influence well, think well. And then at the end of it, after they have an education of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, they are now a well-rounded individual, able to succeed in any sphere of life that they choose to go into. So it's that benefit. The quadrivium is the 4 things, mathematics, geometry, music, and astronomy. Now, if you look at this, and I've said this a few times in the talk, the trivium is a language, is the language arts. The quadrivium are the mathematical arts. So mathematics, geometry, music, I don't know much about music. I'm learning a lot, and as well as astronomy. That's the relationship between time and number, noise and number. And if you're a musician, you can understand that better when you get to understanding harmony and such. So what are some other things about classical education? It's very word-centered. We read a lot of books. We have a lot of books. We mark up our books. We give our students the books. We teach them how to read those books well. It's logos-based, so Christ-centered, as well as text-based. It's also integration of knowledge. Now, if you were to go and look into the TDSB and you look into the curriculum, like the little booklets that Randy was talking about, I go through those also. They all talk about integration, but we're talking about integration in a little different way. So the way I'm speaking about integration, the way it's done in a classical setting, is that in grade 9, for example, they're learning about the ancient civilization, ancient Greek, ancient Roman, ancient Egyptian as well. And then you have the Hebrews in there. Then, in that, in a day, they're learning, they're reading the primary works. So they're reading Homer. They're reading Sophocles. Right now, they're actually performing a play of Antigone written by Sophocles. It's one of the three Theban plays, excuse me. Then they're also learning about the music of that time period. They're learning at the geography of where these things are located, they're also learning about the ideas. So within one day, they're covering, one lesson, they're covering about 5 different subjects. But the reason for that is they're able to go deeper and deeper and deeper into that, so they have a better understanding of life. And how we, and many of our democracy, and many of our monarchy, and many of our ideals stem from that. That's why it's important to learn history. Then we also have a chronological view of history. Grade 9 is ancient, grade 10 is medieval, grade 11 is pre-modern, and grade 12 is modern. Grade 1 is ancient, grade 2 is medieval, grade 3 is pre-modern, grade 4 is modern, grade 5 is ancient. Do you see the pattern? So that each time that they go through it in grades 1, 5, and 9, they're going to go through it deeper and deeper and deeper, making deeper connections each time they go about it. So they can have a full-orbed understanding. So when you talk about holistic education, this is holistic. Lifelong learners. At the end of it, they're going to be able to know how to learn. They're going to know how to study. They're going to learn how to read books well and to take this information and logically deduce it to where it's going to be going to in its arguments, and then either to agree with it or present a better model. And then in the end, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the talk, it's the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. It's the Christ as the foundation. So, now I do have a few questions that I'm typically asked, and I'll speak to them in just a minute. You can also ask more questions when we have our panel discussion. I recognize we're getting close to time. But 2 questions that I'm often asked. This is the first one. What if my child has never had a classical education? I have a child in grade 5 or going into grade 5. They haven't had classical education up to this point. Will they be at a disadvantage? They're going to be in a classroom with a bunch of other classically educated students since kindergarten, and won't my child be at a disadvantage? Absolutely not. If anything, we need to switch the question. They have everything to gain by that. If we can actually go back right there, is the other thing. It gives them, even if they're there just for 1 year, we get to do a little bit of deprogramming and then reformatting. We want to give them a comprehensive view of subjects and historical time. We want to give them a little taste, a little foretaste of what they could have. We also want to give them a more humble critique of ideas and knowledge. In the end, we hope that they would possess the ideas and skills necessary to be successful in any and every vocation. And that's they can come in at any point. At any point, the teacher is going to employ a classical methodology in order for them to not quickly get on board with the classical approach, but then they will begin to understand better and deeper as well. So they have only everything to gain by even just a little bit at a classical school. The next question I'm often asked is this: you know, the world is rapidly changing. We don't really know what the world's going to look like in 5-10 years because of technology advancements and infrastructure and so on. I mean, who would have known that just 10 years ago, the influence that Google and Amazon would have on our world? So it's changing dramatically. So is something so ancient, an ancient approach, is that still relevant? Well, the answer is yes, and it's partly what I talked about before, about how tech companies are now reaching out to humanities approach students in university. Well, and it's because they have foundations of the language and mathematical arts. We talk about numbers, like what Randy mentioned in the area of math. Two things have been coming up in the news lately. One is that the great inflation. You've heard of that? Great inflation. Well, that's a concern. So universities have been tracking students. So if a student from my school goes into a university and they have a glowing report card, an OSSD, and the transcripts looks really good, and they go into University of Toronto, within the first 2 years, if they fail, well, the university keeps track of that. And for the past 10 years, almost probably, they believe, every university has been tracking the students that they have who have been failing and what schools they have come from. Have you heard this? It gets fun. Because what happened is that it leaked. So one university, I can't remember which one it was, but one university, a list got out of the top 30 schools who are the biggest violators of this, of schools who for the past 10 years have been sending students with grades that have been glowing, and then those students drop out after the freshman year of college. And these are schools, not just public schools, but these are good, reputable private schools as well. Now, why is that concerning? Because these schools are trying to play a game. It becomes a game of getting into university now. And I don't want to be focused and driven by playing the game. I want a student to be articulate, and I want a student to be wise, and I want a student to love the Lord more than anything. And that's why I think that this approach is honoring. Now, I can stand here confident that our school is not on that list. We don't have a graduate yet, so it doesn't. So I have one student in currently grade 11 going into grade 12. They've committed to graduating with us. So I've told her there's a lot at stake on her. And then also there's the tech companies. I would say, please think about some questions, because we want this time to be very helpful to you. Personally, I got into Christian classical education. I just got into Christian education. I didn't care about classical. That wasn't a value to me. I didn't know what it was. I had to move back home because my dad had cancer, so I thought I'd help out at home a little bit. And all I wanted to do was coach golf, and I figured I had to teach a lesson, so I thought I'd teach history. It seemed easy enough to learn. And then I got hired on at a Christian classical school. Again, that wasn't my value. It wasn't my goal. But then in year three, I noticed something different. I taught middle school. So I had grade 8 students who had a classical education from the very beginning. And here's what I noticed. They were better thinkers than I was. And I was a teacher. I had experience, a life experience. I didn't have a good education. I know that. And when I noticed that they were better thinkers, I also noticed something else. I became to be a better thinker because of the classical education that I was teaching. So I am compelled by classical education. Not in a sense of like, John 14:6, that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. I'm not to that standard. But I do believe in the power of a classical education and what it does to a child, to a family. And also when you're at this idea of taking dominion, I think it's important for churches to start Christian schools and preferably Christian classical schools, because classical education, this idea of taking dominion, I think it's very, very important. And even if you look at advancing the kingdom, this propagation, it's starting schools in pockets. Not necessarily in a Dutch approach to where it's very insular, but in a way that branches out and touches culture and touches life and says, we can do things differently and we believe we can do things better. So I think that in this, as you're thinking about whether to start a school, please do. You know what? It's not that hard. And let that be an encouragement, even from a ministry standpoint. It's five things you need in order to start a school. Have you heard this? You need five students. You need a principal, someone. You need a place to store their student files. You have to have a way of assessing, or a curriculum and then assessing that curriculum. So a handbook will do that. And then you also have to pay $300. And then if it's approved, you can have a school. And I'm hopeful for classical education in Toronto. I'm hopeful for classical education here in Ontario. I'm hopeful for classical education in all of Canada, because I think that we can do something better. One that honors the mind of the student, blesses the family, and is something that I think will also bless our culture.